The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to this special live edition of the Seneca Podcast, coming to you today from the 2018 Harvard College China Forum in Boston, Massachusetts. Let's hear you folks make a little noise. All right. I am Kaiser Guo, and I am honored to have been asked to moderate the International Relations Panel at the forum this year. The Seneca Podcast, of course, is a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, and we're produced in partnership with SubChina, the best way to keep on top of the latest news from China, through our free daily email newsletter or with our premium SubChina Access membership. SubChina is a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. We are today at a fascinating moment in China's international relations. For the first three decades that followed Deng Xiaoping's ascent to primacy in the Chinese leadership, China hewed to his famous dictum, Tao Guang Yang Hui, to hide your power and bide your time, as it's frequently, if not been literally translated, at least from the time that Xi Jinping became General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party in 2013, and arguably really a few years earlier, inarguably by the time of the 19th Party Congress last fall, we've seen a much more assertive China, one that has backed up its controversial claims in the South China Sea, has pursued the very broad, very far-reaching Belt and Road Initiative, and more recently has taken up the banner of economic globalization. So this advance is coming at a time of retrenchment or even withdrawal by the current U.S. administration, of course, but also at a time when vital security problems remain far from resolved, maybe most notably on the Korean Peninsula. And if we look at the broader global context, the New World Order, which was proclaimed by George H.W. Bush after the end of the Cold War, is now itself over and done. And in many parts of the world, we've seen deeply illiberal strongmen bolstered by populist and nationalist movements, groundswells, who have come to power in Russia, in Turkey, in Hungary, and other Eastern European states, arguably also in India, and arguably even in the United States. Many policymakers here in the U.S., as well as many influential China watchers, have even begun to really question the very wisdom of engagement and have been wondering whether we were wrong to place faith in it in the 1970s and again in the 1990s after Tiananmen. And a growing chorus on both sides of the aisle here in the U.S. are ready to radically rethink engagement and are now advocating instead for confrontation, for containment in a more robust way of China. And, of course, there is the incipient trade war, which you've already heard so much about today. There's some debate over whether it's already begun, as many now say, or whether at this late stage in the game it's in any way avoidable. In any case, it's more urgent than ever, I think, for us to understand how China is navigating this dynamic situation, how it evaluates the threats and the opportunities now available to it. And so I'm delighted to introduce you to our excellent panel. Excellent, but for the fact that it is all male. I want it noted that some of us protested this fact and asked very early on that it be made more diverse, but that the organizers did make some effort toward that, but were not, I'm afraid, ultimately successful. You can do better next time, I think. No excuses next time, right? Right. Good. In any case, our panel today. First, I'd like to introduce immediately to my left, Dr. Jiang Changjian, who is perhaps best known today as the host of the fantastically popular show on Jiangsu television, Zui Chang Da Nao, or Super Brain, in which people with off-the-charts IQs compete in astonishing feats of mathematical, logical, mnemonic prowess, and make the rest of us feel incredibly stupid.
No.
Or I suppose for some of us, it's actually inspiring. I don't know. I'm in the feeling stupid camp. If you haven't seen the show, though, it's really mind-blowing, and I highly recommend it. He's also associate professor at the School of International Relations and Public Affairs at Fudan University. Professor Jiang, let's just call you Changjian through this whole thing, if you don't mind. Welcome to Seneca.
Thank you. So this is my first time to do this show.
And I
so
think
I get used to the show on the camera, not just the wristway.
Right, right. So just treat this as a camera, and we're good. Okay. So I think Dr. Zhang has bravely decided he's going to eventually do this in English, not his first language. But I'm very happy that he's done this because it's a podcast. We can't subtitle.
I'll try.
It, right. Also joining us for the first time is Ira Kasoff. Ira is senior counselor and member of APCO Worldwide's International Advisory Council, and is a former deputy assistant secretary for Asia at the U.S. Department of Commerce. Ira, great to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I apologize for not being a woman.
Okay. I mean, at least some of us have hair like a woman. Yeah. Tony Saish is next. He's director of the Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation, and he's Daewoo Professor of International Affairs at the Kennedy School at Harvard University. He is a prolific commentator on China's politics and international relations, a very well-regarded scholar. I have long wanted to have him on the show. Tony, a very warm welcome to you.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So there are many, many geographies that I would love to talk about, but since time is limited, we're going to have to be somewhat selective. Let's start with the topic of China's overall orientation, and let's start with you, Dr. Zhang Changjie. So in the introduction just now, I talked about the end of Tao Guang Yanghui, or hide your strength and bide your time. First of all, do you agree with this characterization? Is that period over now?
Can I modify your concept of the Tao Guang Yanghui
in
English?
Absolutely.
I would like to say Tao Guang Yanghui is a keep low profile. Not
okay.
just high power. If you say high power, that means today I hide power, that tomorrow I will show my power. So I would like to say Tao Guang Yanghui is a keep low profile.
Okay. But is the profile still being kept low?
I think so.
Okay. So
on many issues, the China still humble and keep low profile.
Oh, that's very interesting. Do you think that the changes that we have seen, because you, sure, maybe a low profile still in some issues, but it's raised its profile in other areas. And in those areas in which it's raised it, do you attribute this to the person of Xi Jinping? Do you attribute it maybe to broader forces, a broader sort of balance of power to China's economic ascent? Or what do you think is causing this shift, if indeed you see a shift?
So, if I say something about the China issues, it's maybe not so balanced. So I leave this question to you two guys.
Oh, come on. You can answer. That's okay. We won't get you in any trouble.
Okay. I mean, if I were to chip in, I would say looking at it externally, I think there's been a very significant shift in behavior. But I don't think it originated with Xi Jinping. I mean, I think it occurred really around 2008, 2009. And I think it's quite justifiable, quite understandable. China was very proud of its achievements over the period of time. And of course, you had at that point the global financial crisis and basically set off for the United States of America. And I think that gave the Chinese government great confidence in the fact that perhaps their model was going to be very effective, that it didn't have to concentrate so much on thinking about what America did or how America did it, or more broadly, how the West did it. And so I think from that time, you saw a kind of increasing confidence, not just with the government, but also from Chinese people about their own achievements, what they were doing. And that's played through, I think, in positive ways, in the sense that China has been very engaged in discussions around things such as climate change, and in other ways which are more problematic, for example, around territorial claims in the South China Seas and elsewhere. I mean, to the point where it clearly upset some of the other Southeast Asian countries, and some of those people in those countries talked about a concern whether China was really abandoning its long-term objectives for short-term gains. So, you know, I don't think that's keeping a low profile. And as I said, I think it's positive, and I think it's also had some problematic aspects to it. And you know, it relates to the kind of churn and the friction that we're seeing when you combine that with some of the behavior by the United States in the recent period.
Ira, this period, 2008-2009, I think you would probably agree was sort of an inflection point, yeah? And if I remember correctly, you were actually you were at Commerce at the time, and you were assistant deputy for Asia, and you were part of the S&ED dialogues at that time, at the end of 2008, is that right?
That's right. Actually, at that time, it was the SED.
Oh, right.
A big change was to change it to the S&ED under Obama, but that's a very technical point. But yeah, we had the Strategic Economic Dialogue, which was chaired by, on the U.S. side, by Secretary Paulson, Secretary of Treasury, and on the Chinese side by Wang Qishan. And the last meeting of that dialogue was in December of 2008, which was after the presidential election. So the U.S. side, the cabinet secretaries were all what we call lame ducks. They were on the way out. And it was also right in the middle of this financial crisis where we were all worried about whether the economy was going to melt down completely. And in the previous meetings of the SED, which took place twice a year, the U.S. side, led by Secretary Paulson, would generally push the Chinese to try to open up markets and increase capital flows and so on and so forth. And at the December 2008 meeting, we basically had to sit there and listen while Wang Qishan lectured us and pointed his finger and said, "You have been our teachers, but look what you've done to international markets, and you are no longer our teachers." And we basically had to just sit there. So I think that was actually a very tangible inflection point that we could see.
Yeah, I've often pointed to that moment, I guess in August and September of 2008, when, you know, I think the closing ceremonies of the Beijing Olympics, you know, Beijing's great coming out party, as they talked about, took place almost 3 weeks to the day before the collapse of Lehman Brothers. It's a very kind of interesting
moment.
So
I have one point I should add. So what I mean about the keep low provide, it is necessary mean, it's not necessary mean that the China government, even the President Xi Jinping, if they meet some core interest of China, we should keep low profile. Okay? We must continue step on the hard line to protect our core interest. That's very important. And we also seek the multilateral resolution to some big challenges we are facing up, not just go with the single lateral resolution.
Yeah, no unilateralism, I understand. So Ira, we worked, as we said, in the Department of Commerce, and so you're the natural person to ask this next question. You know, let's deal with the elephant in the room, as it were. This current state of trade between the U.S. and China, we know that things have escalated since the announcement of steel and aluminum tariffs. There was the $60 billion in punitive 301 tariffs that were announced by President Trump in late March, and then China's announcement of retaliatory tariffs in roughly that same amount. And then, just Thursday night, the other night, Trump threatened to impose new tariffs amounting to $100 billion. Can we dispense with the word looming and call this a trade war already underway? And put us in the heads of the principal actors here in this incipient trade war, if you would, and give us your sense for how you think this plays out.
I don't like to try to get into the head of Donald Trump. It's a very dangerous dangerous place, and I don't
want to get into his anything.
Yeah, I might not get out. I think we still need to call it a looming trade war. I don't think we're quite into it yet. Okay. The 301 report that you referred to, where the USTR has put out, I think, something like 1,200 items that will be subject to these tariffs, actually won't take effect until late May. So there's now about 6 weeks before they take effect, during which time the two sides can negotiate and try to avert a trade war. Now, it's gotten much hotter, again, as you mentioned, because President Trump responded to China's response by saying, okay, we're going to hit another $100 billion worth of products. That is not a formal proposal even yet. In order for it to become formalized, first USTR would again need to put out a report for public comment. But let me just maybe make one more comment before we leave this subject, or a couple of comments. One is, I think there are really two aspects to this, at least from the U.S. Perspective. One is the bilateral trade deficit itself. President Trump keeps throwing out the number of $500 billion, which is actually nonsense. The trade deficit, according to official U.S. trade statistics, is about $350 billion. And so that's one aspect. And in my view, the focus on that is misguided. But there's another aspect, which is the a focus on China's industrial policy, and specifically the Made in China 2025 policy, I think is a more serious long-term issue. But so let me just talk about the trade deficit briefly. Maybe we can save the industrial policy for later. But as I said, it's about $350 billion. Although trade statistics, without getting too technical, they're kind of misleading, because China is actually the final assembly point for a lot of products that get exported to the U.S. But if you really break it down, about 40% of those products actually are inputs that come from other countries, are sent to China and then assembled into final products and sent to the U.S. So you really have three numbers. You have Donald Trump's $500 billion, which is made up. You have the official $350 billion number, which is a little bit misleading. The real number of the value added in China is about $200 billion roughly. And that's those are equate to jobs, basically. So it's still a big trade deficit, but it's not as big as it's made out to be.
Right. And conveniently, the value added deficit is $150 billion less, which is $150 billion less than Trump's nominal. So, and that $150 billion is the total value of threatened tariffs so far. So maybe this is the way he gracefully xiatais.
I'm not sure I don't think he quite understands it to that level. But anyway.
But you mentioned Made in China 2025, and I think there are a lot of commentators who have now sort of zeroed in on this as the ultimate, really. I mean, this is what the 301 report was ultimately about, even though it didn't name the U.S. has always opposed industrial policy, right? I mean, if we remember back to the 1980s, the big bugbear for them was Japan's MITI, the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, right?
Yes.
So this is something that the U.S. has opposed. But does the U.S. not itself engage in some forms of industrial policy and just not call it that? And what do you think explains the hostility to, what many other countries do, which is, big champions, plan, subsidize key technologies that they think are going to be important in the future? Seems an incredibly sensible approach, does it not?
I'm not sure. I should note that I was actually posted at the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo when we were fighting with MITI back in the early 90s, so I do have some experience with that. The U.S., you could argue that the U.S. does practice some industrial policy, but I think not to the extent that Japan did or that China is doing now. And I personally think that the Made in China 2025 plan is a more long-term, almost an existential threat to the U.S. because what China is looking to do is to dominate emerging high-technology industries.
These are artificial intelligence, big data,
that's
advanced
right,
robotics,
that's
genomics,
right.
Things like that. Right?
And so if you look at the USTR report, the 301 report that came out, really goes into great detail on this and talks about, for example, forced technology transfer, theft of intellectual property, license problems with licensing agreements, and so forth, and really tries to get at this problem in several ways. One is the tariffs that we've touched on, but in addition, they're bringing a WTO case. They're trying to restrict China's acquisition of sensitive technologies from the U.S. And so forth. Because putting tariffs on Chinese products, we can come back to that. That is basically not going to bring jobs back to the U.S. But the real threat to the U.S. is if China dominates these emerging industries the way it did low-cost manufacturing, that is basically an attack on the U.S. head-on. That's where the U.S. strength lies.
Very good. So I want to ask Tony one question before we move back to Dr. Jiang. Tony, what's your sense of Beijing's response so far to the tariff announcements? I mean, many media outlets in the U.S. have focused on the fact that China's tariffs have largely targeted red states. Of course, Boeing is not in a red state. It's in the state of Washington. But other than that, I mean, if you look at pork, corn, especially soybeans, many of these are states that either went for Trump and went for Romney and Ryan in 2012, but also swing states, as in the Midwest, the Michigans, the Wisconsins, Pennsylvanians, and the Ohios. What do you make of this claim by the United States? This is sort of hitting below the belt and meddling effectively internal U.S. politics. Is this going to backfire maybe on China?
I don't think it's going to backfire. Before I come to answer that, though, I want to make a broader point, and that is that I think that the elites in the U.S. and also in the West generally have been losing the debate about the value of trade. Because if we think back, President Trump at least has been consistent on one thing, and that's his misunderstanding of trade and what he wants to see in terms of trade agreements. But remember, Hillary Clinton also ran on a platform that she was going to pull us out of TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. So I think what has happened is that there's a general loss of the debate where the values and the long-term benefits of trade are being pushed to one side, and people are beginning to focus on dislocation, unemployment, which of course happens. So I really think there's a very serious job to be done by elites in the West to claw back and win back some of the arguments around these issues. Now, coming more specifically then to your question, I mean, the first thing, of course, is if President Trump goes ahead with another $100 billion of tariffs and China responds, China's going to run out of U.S. exports that it can put tariffs on, because if there is only $150 billion exported from the U.S., that's pretty much filled up with tariffs already. So then it's going to have to move to a second strategy, which is focusing on companies that are American companies producing within China. And there I think the problem is that for American investors in China, it's part of a strategic global plan. Most of the things are integrated with corporate headquarters. They may be part of the global value chain, their production chain. So it could damage them really badly if one got into a more extensive trade war. If you look by contrast to Chinese investments into America, they're not integrated in the same way into Chinese businesses. And they've been very ad hoc. You know, they're rather like the early Japanese investments, paying over the odds for properties. Yeah, exactly. And so it would not hit the Chinese economy in quite the same way. Then you're right. I mean, I think it is true that they've been very strategic. I heard that they'd already set up a task force before President Trump took over to look at this question of if tariffs came in, where could they respond most effectively. I saw a figure recently that something like 82% of counties that voted for Trump are affected by the tariffs, so they've clearly targeted very well. I think there's two other things, though, which are important to bear in mind in the relationship with this. And the first of these is that there's a broader response going on, and this relates to Ira's point about emerging industries and standards, and that's the Belt and Road Initiative. I think this is tremendously important in the way China sees its future developing. And whether it's right or wrong, I think one of the things it's learned from other countries when they've been the dominant economy is they've tended to set global standards in industries. And I think China's looking to push that through Belt and Road, and I think they hope that that will upgrade their own domestic industries as a result. So I think there's a broader strategy which is actually taking place and is going on here than just this immediate response to the question of the tariffs and responses to tariffs. And I cannot for the life of me remember what the second point was that I was going to make.
Can I make one more point on
you
this before we move
sure.
on?
Okay.
Yeah, while you're thinking of yours. Tony quite rightly pointed out what the Chinese could do if we do in fact enter a trade war, i.e. hit American companies that are operating in China. If you just think about Apple or GM, how big their sales are in China of products that are actually manufactured in China. So they're not exports, but they still are critical to the success of those companies. But there's even a third tool in the Chinese toolkit, which is much more consequential. China holds roughly $1.2 trillion of U.S. debt. All they would need to do is not show up at treasury auctions to send the message that we can really hurt the U.S. economy. And then ultimately, if they really wanted to hurt the U.S. economy, they could start selling down some of their holdings. Now, that would hurt China as well, but the U.S. would suffer much more. I mean, interest rates would take off in this country if China were to do that.
Do you think that Trump, Lighthizer, all these folks, do they understand that any country that is going to run such enormous deficits is going to have to borrow, and that the only countries that they borrow from are it is a natural, they will create trade deficits. That's simply, it's almost an ironclad economic law.
I think.
Do they not understand this basic principle?
My guess is that Lighthizer understands that. I don't want to get into Trump's head, as I said, but I don't think he does understand it. If you look at his rhetoric or his positions, he's changed his position over time on almost everything. The one area where he has not changed his position is bilateral trade, going all the way back to the 80s with Japan.
Still sees it as a zero-sum game. Right?
Yeah, he thinks it's a zero-sum game. A trade surplus means you're a winner. A trade deficit means you're a loser. And, of course, we know he likes winners. And I don't think he thinks beyond that. I don't think he understands what lies below that and what the consequences are of these actions.
Well,
and
we
then,
have
of course,
a lot of
he's
trouble.
Got Peter Navarro whispering in his ear, who's always maintained a pretty simplistic stance on trade and role of trade.
So, you know, Dr. Zhang, we have a lot of trouble understanding Trump here in America. I can't imagine what it's like to try to understand him in China. I think that it's probably fair to say that when he first was elected, there was a lot of mad scrambling in Beijing. They tried.
It's normal. Both sides have some problem, especially at the early stage of new presidency.
Yeah, that's absolutely normal. But I mean, but the radical shifts back and forth. I mean, they probably thought that they had his number for a while. They had him dialed, and they figured out that maybe they could serve his vanity with a little flattery and so forth, and that he would you know be a shumao.
Yeah, you know, China is not my subject.
Right.
I will give a broad response to these issues. Or I sit here like an idiot if I speak in English. So please allow me speak in Chinese. Try to make me smarter.
Okay, you were allowed one question in Chinese.
Yeah, you can do some a little bit of translation.
Bear with me,
listeners. I'm not an expert on trade issues, but regarding what was just discussed, I have a few things to say. The first is concerning the Made in China 2025 initiative and its threats to America. In what way can I address this? The rise of high-tech and new technology industries, of course, is closely tied to developed Western countries because we learned a lot from them. However, don't forget, the vast Chinese market in return gave the application of high-tech and other new business models tremendous impetus that you can't find in other countries. Therefore, the internal factors that will determine the success of Made in China 2025 cannot be overlooked. We can't just attribute our success to opportunities given by developed countries. Meanwhile, we need to thoroughly consider how the massive market in China can provide a huge opportunity for the global high-tech industry and various business models. In the past, China had to copy from elsewhere. Now, other countries have begun to copy from China. I think careful consideration needs to be applied to whether or not the Made in China 2025 plan is a threat to other countries. Second, regarding China's manufacturing industry, don't forget, during China's period of economic opening during the 1980s and 1990s, the American economy was confronted with many difficulties. China's opening policy facilitated the transformation of traditional American manufacturing industries by providing a huge market. And at the same time, it also helped China's manufacturing industry develop very quickly in a short period of time. In fact, rather than a zero-sum game, this is a reciprocal relationship and mutual beneficial process. This period of history cannot be forgotten. Furthermore, when China entered the World Trade Organization, it was approved by the United States Congress, right? I believe when intelligent American politicians made the decision, they must have done some economic and political calculations. Has this brought about any benefit to American interests? Of course it has. This point should not be overlooked. So I agree with the central points made by the previous two speakers. I'm unwilling to use the word war to describe the current conflict. It will take a few months for the conflict to have real effects. And before that, for politicians, a couple of months is enough to carry out all kinds of negotiations, whether those be public or covert. Therefore, I'm not so pessimistic. Rather, I'm cautiously optimistic, because looking back at the history of U.S.-China relations, whenever a new administration was elected, difficulties always arose, but all of them were solved eventually. So I am indulging myself with optimism.
I hope that your cautious optimism is proved correct. There's a lot more, of course, to Chinese international relations than just the bilateral relationship with the United States. I want to talk more broadly about Chinese foreign policy and how it's created. Tony, maybe you can help us to understand how we should understand the formation of Chinese foreign policy. Xi Jinping has arrogated to himself many functions through his control of leading groups, and he has created, of course, this National Security Commission that he chairs, and which I imagine must have pretty considerable sway in determining Chinese foreign policy. So should we now understand China's foreign policy, its grand strategy, its major bilateral relationships, at least, as being directed or controlled by Xi Jinping himself? And if so, what are the implications for that, Tony?
Well, first, I don't think China has a grand strategy, so that would get that question out of the way.
That's an interesting claim. I mean,
but where's the evidence?
Do you think it's entirely ad hoc? Do you think that there is not?
Well, there's grand slogans, but I think you have to look at actual practice. And I think if you look at actual practice, I don't think it's shifted very significantly, except in one area, which I'll come back to in a moment. I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think the answer to your question is yes and no. Yes, in the sense that obviously President Xi has taken considerable powers, re-centralized a lot of control to himself. But, you know, China is not the China under Mao. And basically, you know, if we go back that far, most Chinese citizens, Chinese organizations had no vested interest in what their external policy was or what the international relations were. That is obviously not the case any longer. I mean, you have very diverse interests within China, from the military interest, from business interest, private business, state-owned enterprises interests, citizens wanting to travel internationally, wanting to do a range of different things. So it's a much more complex environment to deal with. And those kind of have to be meshed together. And they come together in somewhat simplistic slogans, you know, of the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation or the China dream, those sorts of slogans, which, you know, are used to try and bring together a kind of national esprit de corps. But I don't think they really resolve themselves very strongly into policy. I think the one exception which we see is now the Belt and Road Initiative. Again, I defy anybody to actually tell me what the Belt and Road Initiative is. I mean, I know there's official definitions, but if most of the Belt and Road Initiative is taking place outside of the Belt and Road, it doesn't count for very much. And there, I think there's two interesting things, and it shows the influence of internal agencies on shaping policy. Because this was announced with a lot of fanfare, but pretty soon provincial organizations, different agencies at the center, like the National Development Reform Commission, began to want to shape One Belt, One Road to their own interests. So every province now has a Belt and Road plan. And of course, some of the southern provinces didn't like the idea that Belt and Road initially was only going out through Central Asia. Right. So they pushed in, of course, and got a maritime road. So you can see there's a lot of different interests that are very adept at picking up on slogans, playing them, and turning them to their own interests. However, of course, that is a Xi slogan. And this is where I think there's a problem, because it's now in the Constitution. And that means it has to work. And that means that people might take injudicious decisions. So I think a lot of state-owned enterprises, for example, they say they're only going to do commercial-based projects, but at the end of the day, they might come under political pressure to show that they are conforming with Belt and Road. And when we think about it, there's not that many profitable projects out there. So that is the one thing, I think, which has become a signature of Xi Jinping and may be problematic. He clearly wants to take a strong role in being seen as an equal to the United States of America. And in many ways, I think that's justified. I mean, I think if we leave aside restructuring kind of existing organizations, if we look at the kinds of new global challenges around global commons, global regulation, China has to be an equal partner, I think, in devising the rules of the game. And I think that is something that Xi Jinping is pushing for. And I think it's something that probably many Chinese people would support, that they would have pride in their nation pushing that forward.
Changtian, would you agree with what Tony Saisha said about there not being a Chinese grand strategy? Do you think that there is one? Do you think that maybe looking at pronouncements from the 18th and now from the 19th Party Congress, especially from the Congress itself and from the two meetings, that coupled with Belt and Road being written into the Constitution, that rises to a grand strategy?
We have some misunderstanding about the China dream. We separate the China dream with the enhanced interest of we call the 人类, 生命共同体. Okay? Like we live in the same room, we lie on the same bed, we have a different dream. But nobody have a dream will damage the roof and the broken windows, right? So we cannot separate the China's dream with the interest of the 人类生命共同体.
So what about the idea of grand strategy? I mean, that maybe clears up some of our misunderstandings about what is meant by China dream. But what about, do you think that if you look at the pronouncements that are now part of the Constitution and this about China taking a more proactive role, center stage in global affairs, does this not to you constitute a direction for Chinese strategy internationally? No,
I don't think the China has this strategy that means replace the United States to be a global leader. So, of course, we should take some responsibility, especially in the global society governance, like the counter the terrorism and solving global warming problems,
sure.
And uphold the principle of the free trade. And also, we should do something to protect long nuclear proliferation.
Sure.
Yeah.
Staying with you, though,
that not necessarily means if we take these actions, we take these responsibilities, means oh, you will be global leader. No, we should work with the big powers, and we should seek the ways like the multilateral resolution. Yeah.
All right.
Just a quick point to add to what's been said. I think, in very general terms, I think there is a grand strategy, and that is to reassume China's rightful place in the world. I think, I don't know how concretely it's been thought out, but I think that's what's at work here. And if you think about the Belt and Road, it's essentially a modern day version of the old Silk Road. And when the Silk Road was thriving in the Tang Dynasty, China was in fact the Zhongguo, the Middle Kingdom. It was the center of the world. And I think these days it's more vague, and it probably focuses on being the center in East Asia, not necessarily the world. But I think that's what's at work here, is this, after this long period of decline since the 19th century, China is moving to reassert and reassume its rightful place in the world.
Yes, I mean, I agree with that. I think it's aspirational rather than an actual strategy that you can see working out on the ground. And as for the China dream, one of the most tangible things that I've seen of it is selling soap on television. I mean, nearly every product now is banded as part of the China dream. You know, wash yourself with our soap. It's great for the China dream.
Right. It's important to smell good.
So I'm staying with you, Chang Jian. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of commentators have suggested that if you look at the removal of term limits and couple that with some of the things that he said about the fulfillment of some of the most cherished parts of the China dream, they've interpreted this to mean the project of reunification that Xi will, within the tenure of his term, now seek to reunify China and Taiwan. What do you make of this claim?
Can I deliver in Chinese?
Sure. I'm going to hire a
translator. Okay, it's quite a sensitive topic. Okay. I don't want to use the official tongue to give my response to your question, but I should say something about this.
From the establishment of the People's Republic of China in 1949 until the present, the country has achieved a lot. However, we're still not a fully united country, right? Taiwan has not returned to the arms of its motherland yet. I suppose every politician has dreamt of realizing the reunification of their countries. Of course, I'm not referring to anyone in particular. What I'm saying is that every leader of the People's Republic of China would consider a fully united country as their important political ambition. But I myself am not sure as to how to realize the dream and whether or not there is a timetable. The reports of the 18th and 19th Party Congresses clearly indicate that by 2049, we will carry out the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. The country will become prosperous, the nation will develop, and the people will be happy. What is the meaning of the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation? I think for China, it's a response to the more than 200 years history of humiliation, colonization, oppression, and being divided. From this perspective, you can use political imagination. But if we take the reports on the 18th and 19th Congresses as our primary source, it's safe to say that we want to achieve national rejuvenation by 2049. I personally don't want to wait that long, but my wish does not reflect the political leaders of China. As to how to solve the issue and which political approach to take, I believe Chinese politicians have the adequate intellectual capacity to figure out the plan.
但是如果,
of course, if some politicians want to divide Taiwan from China, we believe that the adoption of more staunch measures is also a possibility. If you want to know what Chinese people think in terms of what measures China should take to stop Taiwan from independence, I can tell you what the answer will be. There is no need to conduct a poll. So does the government need to listen to public opinion? Of course they do. So from this perspective, we definitely want to address the problem through peaceful measures. And I'm confident that Chinese political leaders are smart enough to sort out peaceful measures to solve the issue.
Tony or Ira, do you want to add anything to that? Is that your reading? So basically in the 18th and 19th Party Congress statements, this setting this goal of realizing the great rejuvenation of the Chinese people by the year 2049, is this sort of an implicit call for reunification by the state?
You could read it that way, but I think reality sinks in and what the consequences are. And I think, yes, if there was a peaceful reunification, most people would be quite happy with that. But I think from Taiwan's perspective, that requires considerable changes on the mainland. I think it also, they would be watching very carefully with the way the mainland treats Hong Kong to see whether that is an integration they would desire. I think the question is this really a crucial issue to Chinese people or not? I mean, if I ask, Chinese people, eating Yao Jie Fang Taiwan, do you really want to liberate Taiwan? Yes, I do. But then you say, okay, but the consequences of that would be the collapse of your economy. It would possibly be armed conflict, the United States of America. Oh, no, I don't want that, but I do want to liberate Taiwan. So I think it's not really thought through fully what the consequences of that might be under those circumstances. And I think, historically, the Chinese Communist Party has been very flexible. I don't know how many people in the room know, but for example, in the Geming Gunjudi, in the revolutionary base areas, if you look at maps and stamps of the Chinese Communist Party, Mongolia is a part of China, indisputably. Taiwan is not. It was not considered a part of the mainland. And so that changed historically over time. So in the past, China's been very flexible about what it determines as being part of its sovereign land and what isn't. I think the crucial question becomes, what would international response be? And I think it would be very different if Taiwan declared independence. And as a result of Taiwan declaring independence, China moved against it. Then I think you would find less international support coming to Taiwan.
Right.
If China were to attack Taiwan aggressively without it having declared independence, then I suspect there would be quite a dramatic international response, which could have very problematic consequences for China. So I would agree with the previous comments that if it could move towards some kind of peaceful solution and resolution, then I think pretty much everybody would sign on to that. But we know the constraints are considerable. China could look very different by 2049. The world could look very different by 2049.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add?
Yeah, sure.
Kaiser, I tend to have more simplistic views of these things, and
tend to relate them to my personal experiences. But I lived in Taiwan in the early 70s, which I guess is dating myself, but Chiang Kai-shek was still alive. Taiwan was under martial law. And then I lived in China first in 1979. And in the 70s, there was zero contact between the two sides. There were propaganda billboards everywhere, and there was still technically a state of war. If you look at what's happened since then, and particularly in the last 10 years or so, huge trade flows, huge investment flows, huge tourism back and forth. It's a completely different world. There are something like 2 million Taiwanese now living in mainland China out of a population of 23 million. So that's a huge percentage of the Taiwanese population. So it has always seemed to me that they were moving, the two sides were moving in a kind of a de facto way towards reunification. And it was just a matter at some point of pragmatic leaders on both sides saying, okay, we've reunified, we're going to keep things the way they are. The problem is solved. But it's obviously not so simple. And you have had now many years, the number of people who went to Taiwan from the mainland, there are not so many of them alive. Most of the people in Taiwan now don't feel any connection anymore to China. And they see what's happened there versus how Taiwan has developed and become a democracy and so forth.
Right, so the time is both the ally and the enemy.
So they have less interest in any kind of a reunification. And I think Chinese leaders see that as well and are getting impatient. So there may be increasing pressure for the Chinese leaders to increase the pressure on Taiwan.
I want to move now to the topic of Sino-Russian relations. Tony, you might have heard that just the other day, China's newly appointed Minister of Defense, Wei Fenghe, along with State Councilor and former Foreign Minister Wang Yi, visited Russia. They made statements that raised some eyebrows about the Russia and the Russo-Chinese relationship, saying that Russia and China are closer than you think. So what do you make of this? And in the context of this deepening chill in Russian relations with the West, and in this context of deepening chill between China and the U.S., especially over, with Europe and the United States over this alleged nerve agent poisoning of an ex-double agent and his daughter in the U.K., what do you make of this visit?
I think if you look back over the last 20, 30 years, when there's friction with Washington, Russia and China always cozy up to one another.
So it's sort of standard dynamics of the strategic triangle.
And I think it's, you know, they want to put pressure on Washington by saying, look, you know, we can get together. This could be a problem for you. I think when push comes to shove, both for Beijing and for Moscow, the relationship to Washington is more important than the Moscow-Beijing axis. And, you know, if the relationship improves with Washington on either side, I think you would see less enthusiasm for that relationship. I think, though, I mean, there are natural reasons, obviously, for them to come closer together, in part because, as you said, the report on security for the United States of America has highlighted Russia and China as the two key problems for the country moving forward. So you would think it would make sense for those two countries to come together around a number of issues. I mean, I think they've got a lot to probably share with one another about infiltrating elections in the West. I think they probably have also got a lot to share about use of cyber security, cyber issues. I would think that's probably something that was beneficial. But I do think, you know, there is still, of course, a history of mistrust that goes way back. I mean, even though, you know, the Soviets created the Chinese Communist Party, both in terms of advisors and financing of the party, it was crucial in helping the Chinese Communist Party win the Civil War. It was involved heavily in the 50s. But then there were always suspicions. There was always mistrust, which has always flared up since. And I think one of the key areas it makes sense for Russia and China to talk together is about the Belt and Road Initiative. Because, you know, if I was Russia, I would be very nervous about where the Silk Road is going. You know, it's going through all the various stands. And that's been, in recent years, really Russia's backyard and an area that Russia has wanted to seek control over. So China's expansion into those countries must be very disturbing, I would think, for Russia. And
it's not just in the backyard anymore. It's the front yard as well, right? I mean, with the 16 plus one initiative, China cozying up with Viktor Orban and with the Polish government, even ending many, many years of hostility between China and Poland and the Czech Republic, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, I think China, quite legitimately, is building its own sets of alliances and groupings. We had it starting with the STO, the Shanghai Cooperative Organization. We see it now with the 16 plus one. We see the way it tries to engage with the Southeast Asian nations. I think what is interesting is, China has been able to move in those areas where European Union investment has been weaker and where there has been moves back to more authoritarian nature in the government. And I think there's a very interesting phenomenon happening within the European Union. Chinese investment in Portugal, Greece, and Croatia has become very significant.
Which are the problem children of the...
Exactly. And, Portugal, it's taken over strategic assets that probably would not have been allowed in most other European Union countries. If you roll in then its influence in Hungary, if you roll in the increasing influence in the Czech Republic, it's beginning to form alliances in that perimeter, which those countries, you talk to people in Greece or Portugal, and they say, look, the northern part of the European Union didn't come and help and bail us out. It left us in these problems. The Chinese are coming in and investing. They're taking up what you guys should have been doing. So what you're beginning to see and what I hear from some of the EU diplomats is that those countries now begin to form a bloc, not 100% supporting China's interests, but often responding to things within the European Union about rights issues, other issues in China. And so I think it's been a mixture of strategic and probably incidental business opportunities that have come together to give China a stronger voice and a stronger profile in those countries. But I think 16 plus one, is just another example of as China becomes more influential in the world, the more it's going to play a game. And,
some of it's ad hoc, as you were saying. But
some of it's ad hoc, but I think the other one I want to say, Kaiser, you talked about the one slogan, whether it's keeping a low profile or biting your strength. The other slogan, which has really gone out the window, is that China does not interfere in the affairs of other countries. I mean, it does. I mean, and it can't help but. I mean, when you're that powerful economy and when you're investing, when you're trading, like the US, like the UK, where I'm from originally, we are interfering in the affairs of other countries. And you do begin to form alliances with different parts of the political spectrum. So the sort of simplistic notion that China's an innocent bystander that doesn't behave in a way that other powers have behaved, is coming under duress and I think doesn't apply any longer. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying it's good. It's just a reality.
I was going to say that, I mean, it sounded for a while like you were talking yourself out of your earlier assertion that there is no grand strategy, but okay.
Well, I think, it's interesting. I still don't believe there is the grand strategy.
But
I think it's bits and pieces and ad hoc. And maybe, as Ira says, there's the aspirational aspect to it that as we get to the glorious 2049, which I probably won't be around to see, then, everything will come together.
Advances in Chinese somewhere? Medicine.
Probably not to happen.
Okay, Changjian, I'm sure you have a lot of responses to this, and feel free to use Chinese if you would rather.
I don't fully agree with some of the points he made. If I make an investment in an area where I have business interests and some other properties, do I have to interfere in local politics to solve some problems I encounter? I don't think so. There are two points that I would like to make on the topic of One Belt, One Road. First, One Belt, One Road is not just building projects everywhere. the development and implementation of One Belt, One Road must respect market rules and the basic requirement of mutual benefits. So political safety should be taken into account when we make investments and buy properties. Careful thought must be given to these possible outcomes before forward progress can be made. In addition, China rarely interferes in other countries' internal politics for the sake of benefiting its own people. This, perhaps, is a method which other countries like to employ, but this is not something rooted in Chinese political culture. So I don't particularly agree with the point previously made.
I'm not surprised at all. It's actually already happened
where China in some elections in Africa has come out in statement preferring one candidate over another. There's tensions in Taiwan.
Zimbabwe may have been a case.
I mean, it's inevitable, it seems to me. It doesn't mean necessarily that it's gone in with that intention. But ultimately, you want to start protecting your trade, you want to start protecting your interests, and that's going to involve you in politics in the country.
One geography, though, where sharp power has come to the fore, maybe most prominently, it's in Australia, right, where there's quite a debate raging within our circles, right, Tony, about the extent of and the effect and what can be done about projection of so-called sharp power. Is Beijing reacting at all to this criticism? Has it shown any hesitation, any signs that it might recognize that it has overstepped and provoked a real backlash?
I don't know. I mean, I think some of the things have been exaggerated in Australia. I'm not sure that... actually going back to the previous point, I'm not sure there's been a concerted attempt by the Chinese authorities in the way it's been portrayed by some of the
Clive Hamilton and such.
And yeah, exactly. And that's created a buzz, it's created a stir. But just think about the huge number of Chinese students that are in Australia, many of whom have nothing to do with this, have no interest in that those issues. So I'm not sure. And to be honest, I don't know how deep it really goes. And I've heard sensible Australian voices on both sides, and particularly, most importantly, Australian voices which have said, don't demonize Chinese citizens in this country, because that is clearly not beneficial to Australia. It's not beneficial to China. And I think a lot of this has become, overblown.
Absolutely. I think we can all agree with that. Yeah.
And, of course, embassies, they work to promote their own interests. We know that in the U.S. they support certain activities. They don't like other activities. But again, it doesn't seem to me entirely abnormal behavior in that case. Where I do think China maybe feels it overreached and has pulled back somewhat is in its relationship with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And there, I think, with the challenges around territoriality, I think that created concern in some of the Southeast Asian nations. And so you saw somebody, even like Kishore Mahbubani, who's often been very sympathetic towards China, actually writing publicly that, China needs to be careful not to sacrifice its long-term interests of a win-win strategy in Southeast Asia for short-term gains.
That's right.
And I think since those voices, and I'm sure those voices were said in the corridors of diplomacy, I do see a moderating of China's attitude, that maybe it does feel it overstepped and overexerted its capabilities.
Ira, this whole debate on, well, we can start with Australia, but to what extent do you think it's extensible to the United States? I mean, this is happening here, too. There's this conversation with FBI Director Christopher Wray 2 months ago, talking to the Senate Intelligence Committee and saying that the threat from China is no longer just a whole-of-government threat, but a whole-of-society threat. And, I think a lot of people in this room hear words like that and really bristle and worry about racial profiling, worry about things like that. So, Ira, what's your sense of how that's playing out here?
Well, I think it's first of all, it's not a new issue. I mean, we have had, if you look back at just talking about U.S.-China relations, if you look back, it's kind of waxed and waned, and fears of China have grown at various points and then receded, and then China is our best friend, and
you know, everybody loves the pandas and so forth. So, you know, it's inevitable, I think, that there will be these kinds of tensions as the relationship grows. I forget the latest number. There's probably something like 250,000 Chinese students in America. 350,000 students. Okay. And there's nothing like that, but still a much larger number of American students in China than there were in the past. Trade relations, we talked about how big they are. The bilateral investment relationship is very big, and much more investment coming from China now. So I think inevitably, in that kind of a complicated and intertwined relationship, you're going to see more of these kinds of concerns being raised. But I don't know that materially it's that different from what it was in the past. And just a quick comment on Australia. I don't follow China-Australia relations particularly closely, but I think for Australia, my sense is the tensions have calmed down. It's a very complicated situation because China is by far their largest export market. The investment from China is very big. The tourism flow from China is very big. But at the same time, they are a military ally of the United States. So it's really kind of a delicate balancing act for them.
Let's talk about that military alliance and talk about this idea of the Quad, or how in recent diplomatic parlance, we've revived this idea of the Indo-Pacific when we're referring to it. How is this being viewed right now from Beijing? Is this the pivot part two? Is this maybe something worse? How is Beijing reacting to this idea of leveraging Vietnam and India along with traditional allies, Australia, Japan, to sort of corner China, contain China?
Quite a complex question. I'll divide my response into three portions. We all know China has 10 some odd neighboring countries, whereas America only has a couple. This makes the handling and strategic aspects of Chinese foreign policy incredibly complex. You just discussed the matter of relationships with neighboring countries, and India was brought up. We all know that India shows great promise in the world market, demonstrating rapid development. India hopes to undertake more influence in both the region and the world because the country is becoming stronger and stronger. I can totally understand this aspect. Bearing that in mind, One Belt, One Road offers a window to examine China-India relations. Of course, China hopes that more and more countries will participate in the One Belt, One Road initiative. But we must understand that India has its own plans, projects, and strategies to promote regional economic development. Here, a problem arises. Is conflict an eventuality between Belt and Road proposals and India's economic development plans? Of course it isn't. Rather, is there opportunity for integration? Of course there is. So it's still a subject to study as to how can these two huge new market players form a friendly, consistent, stable, and reciprocal relationship between them while growing their own economies. The topic of Vietnam and other ASEAN countries was brought up, and as we all know, the South China Sea territory is an area of contention. Recently, China and Vietnam have carried out negotiations that will help bring about a good resolution to this problem. Of course, this encompasses other countries as well. We didn't hear many news regarding the issues in the South China Sea lately, and that's because the efforts from various sides are bearing fruit. Australia was also mentioned. Not long ago, there was a variety of opinion about Chinese people on this matter. There are two aspects to this. One is Australia's internal politics. With more and more Chinese doing business and studying in Australia, the Australian government and society has to find a way to address this issue. Under no circumstances should people contemplate this issue through the means of demonizing Chinese people. I believe that in the accelerating process of globalization, where all sides are closely connected, the governments of these two countries must undertake cooperative measures and increase exchanges with one another. On the basis of mutual understanding, I think some solutions can be found to address the issue.
I think one of two more topics before we leave off, and we can leave a little bit of time for maybe questions from the audience. The first, of course, is Japan. Really, since you know the peak of problems in September or so of 2012, after the nationalization of the Diaoyu and Kakko Islands by the Tokyo government, things have cooled down a bit. Things seem to have calmed down quite a bit. Is that your sense of things? Where do things stand? And then we're going to move to North Korea and end it there. But anyone? Who's been watching China, Japan?
I actually have got a couple of comments related to the last question, then I'll try and bring in Japan. I mean, I think there's a very interesting report which was written by Blackwell and Tellis, which I think to a large extent, if the Trump administration had a strategy in Asia, it probably would represent much of the strategy, with the exception of the trade issue. And their starting point is that the U.S. helped China to get to its present state. But now the present state of China is that it's the most singly important threat to U.S. dominance within Asia and also globally. And therefore, they call for the shift in U.S. policy. And that, I think, is where they brought up this Indo-Pacific idea and this idea of a quad. Now, people say that's not containment, but if I was sitting in Beijing and I looked at all those things, it would look a hell of a lot like containment to me. So I think there are questions of perceptions there.
Walks like a duck.
Right. I think the problem is I don't believe the Trump administration really has the patience to pull together effectively that kind of a strategy. What I see as worrying, though, is which others have referred to as an economic Asia, which is emerging, which China is clearly at the core and clearly strong and dominating, and a security Asia, which is still has the U.S. at the core, even though it's being challenged, but still has a strong network of alliances. And those two, you know, the fear is that they might just pull apart over time. And I think the Trump administration deciding not to go ahead with TPP really weakens the U.S. capacity to have knitted together an economic Asia and a security Asia. So I think they've weakened themselves.
So we should count on the Trump administration's incompetence as the last best hope for peace in Asia.
The trouble is, of course, he is going to meet with the dear leader from North Korea. And whether that is a good sign for peace or not, I think is debatable.
Maybe we
but
can
on
talk
the question
North
of
right
Japan,
now,
yeah, I think there is clearly an improvement in relationships. I mean, I think Japanese businesses, you know, also became quite disillusioned with the prospects for their investments in China. I think the Chinese government began to realize just what an extensive role Japan has played in China's development in recent years. I mean, it can't let go entirely the kind of anti-Japanese rhetoric, because that's crucial to legitimacy going all the way back to the anti-Japanese war. But I think they saw it as detrimental and have moved to improve the relationship considerably.
So the last topic is Jin Sanpang visiting Beijing. Kim Jong-un's recent trip to Beijing. A lot of mystery around this, a lot of speculation about what's happening. I'm going to throw it open to the three of you. What have you heard? Have you heard that he came as a supplicant? Have you heard that he secured any kind of a security commitment from China? Have you heard that this was a response to Beijing actually having exceeded the UN mandates for sanctions on North Korea? What's actually happening? Does anyone have a clear idea? I mean, I'd love to hear the Beijing perspective first.
First, I'd like to comment on the Japan issue. You can see that recently there are signs of a warming up of relations between China and Japan. However, during our observations, we are unsure whether these signs of warming up can really persist. So in this context, you must have noticed that we have very rarely heard of debates about the Diaoyu Islands. So why are things warming up? My own observations suggest that there are four elements worth attention. The first one is that we all know nuclear disarmament on the Korean Peninsula will not only benefit the greater region of East Asia, it is also favorable to Japan. The Japanese side must be aware of what role China is playing in it. The second factor is the close relationship between China and Japan's economic development. There is a large amount of Japanese goods in the Chinese market. A massive number of products are imported from Japan into China. Moreover, the two countries are tied closely in terms of tourism and cultural exchange. We can see that while there have been ebbs and flows in China-Japan relations in general, the economic tie remains robust. Thirdly, as China's national strength continues to grow, the international community is hoping China will undertake more responsibility within the global community. China is also hoping to take on more responsibility through mutual cooperation. This type of responsibility makes Japan realize that to solve some of the problems in the global community, China is an indispensable partner. Number four, of course, is a historical reason. There are two meanings. One is negative, which refers to the history of Japan's invasion of China. Until now, many Japanese politicians are still unwilling to address this era. But if we look at this period and expand it and analyze it in a larger context, these two countries have had, for the most part, a very close relationship. So for people from these two countries, especially Japanese people, they have a very complex sentiment towards their Chinese counterparts, given the long history and some misunderstandings and confusion in modern politics. So when we analyze China-Japan relations, this type of shared historical and cultural connections cannot be overlooked. In China, there is a saying, one who understands current events is of great talent. In other words, in the international community, one should be informed of the latest changes that are taking place. Japan, as a member of the international community, must adapt itself according to these changes, rather than be resistant to them. From this perspective, I can analyze the signs that suggest a warming of relations with these four factors.
Okay, 我让那个金三胖再等待一下下，我还想问 one more question related to your second point that you just raised, which is really interesting, and I'd be curious, especially to hear from Ira on this. It just occurs to me that you know, Japan is another very very large trading partner with China, of course. Are tariffs, if they do go ahead in the, at the end of May, are they going to increase China's propensity to import from Japan? Is it going to increase the trade and maybe sort of tighten the network of trade within East Asia, between China and other American allies like Australia? Is this going to be a collateral effect of tariffs?
Yeah, I think it could be. And I think that actually works in both directions. As I mentioned earlier, if the U.S. puts tariffs on Chinese products, it's not going to bring those jobs to the U.S. It's going to force U.S. companies to find other suppliers in foreign countries. I think similarly in China, if they put tariffs on U.S. products and inputs and make them more expensive, a lot of those imports will shift to other suppliers, Japan, Korea, and elsewhere. I think that will work in both directions.
Right. I just wanted to confirm my hunch.
Yeah.
Right. Interesting. Okay, finally, Korea. Who has something to say on this mysterious visit?
Well, let me kick it off if I could. I don't know. I don't have any inside information on the recent trip. Although it was interesting to watch the reporting in the States about the train pulling into Beijing, the mysterious train. Who was on it? I don't think it was that hard to figure out who was on it.
Right.
But I have to say it really worries me. First of all, as far as I know, there's not much expertise left in the U.S. government on Korea. Joe Yuen, who was the senior guy in the State Department on Korea, has retired. They wanted to make Victor Cha U.S. ambassador to South Korea. He had been the Asia guy on the National Security Council previously and has a lot of expertise. He declined the appointment.
Don't worry, there's always Jared Kushner.
There's always Jared Kushner, yeah. My understanding is that there are some secret talks between the CIA and North Korean counterparts, and they may have expertise, I don't know, but it still really concerns me. Not that Trump particularly listens to advisors anyway, but there are many scenarios for how this will play out, assuming it happens, but a couple of them really worry me. One is that Mr. Trump goes and Kim says, if you agree to sign a peace treaty with us and pull your troops out of South Korea, we will denuclearize. And Trump goes, great, it's a deal. My predecessor couldn't have done this. Hillary Clinton couldn't have done this. Only I can do this. And if that happens, you will see an arms race in Korea. Japan and South Korea, in East Asia, I mean, Japan and South Korea will start potentially looking to acquire nuclear weapons. Or they don't get anywhere, and Mr. Trump, who's notoriously impatient, throws his hands up, goes home and says, well, we tried diplomatic channels, they just don't work, so now Mr. Bolton will take the lead on our North Korea policy. So now there are other scenarios, and what I hope happens is that normally a summit like this would be at the end of a long diplomatic process. This may be the beginning of a long diplomatic process, in which the two leaders say, okay, let's move towards denuclearization that can be verifiable, and we will move concurrently towards U.S. concessions that North Korea wants. That's what I hope will come out of this.
Okay,
I think in Trump's eyes, his greatest accomplishment is not inciting this conflict with China. I believe his greatest accomplishment will be to find a solution to the nuclear issues on the Korean Peninsula. Regarding Kim Jong-un's visit to China, what you just discussed, I am on the same page as the rest of you. I have no inside news from Beijing. But I can look at a few aspects regarding the situation. China has an unwavering attitude towards the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Meanwhile, China insists to uphold six-party talks to resolve this issue. Of course, we're more than happy to enjoy the benefits from bilateral negotiations between North Korea and America without doing anything on our side. However, the complicated nature of the Korean Peninsula issues determines the involvement of many sides, other than just North Korea and the United States. In regards to what you just said about the visit by the Russian Minister of Defense, or Wang Yi's visit to Russia, these are not just bilateral communications between China and Russia. It's a tradition for China and the U.S. to keep some diplomatic channels open when it comes to important issues. So regarding Kim Jong-un's visit to Beijing, or the meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un that is approaching, it's normal for China and Russia to discuss such huge matters in their talks. Concerning the future of the Korean Peninsula, I believe Trump should be aware of two aspects. The first is that China's role in the situation is still incredibly important. The second thing Trump should be aware of is the complexity of the issue. For China, we of course want to separate trade issues from political matters. However, when it comes to core interests of a country, all aspects should be taken into account when making a decision. I have confidence in the leaders of these two countries, especially Trump. The professor just raised the questions as to who should be held accountable for the decisions made by the U.S. government. Should it be Trump, his aides, or his consultants? I genuinely have no idea. If you guys in the U.S. don't know, how can I know? That's why I've been following Trump's Twitter closely. I'm trying to understand what he's thinking today, and I wonder what he will do tomorrow.
Tony Sage, last word to you on North Korea.
Well, in terms of your original question, I do think it does seem that China did put a lot of pressure on North Korea to bring Kim to Beijing. And in that sense, I think even though he, of course, his own press announced it very triumphantly, I think it was very much as a supplicant. I think the core problem, of course, is that everybody wants to denuclearize Korean Peninsula. But I think the problem is that the bottom line for America and the bottom line for China are somewhat different, in that America perhaps doesn't care so much if North Korea collapses. Doesn't see that as a major negative, as long as it doesn't collapse in a chaotic way when it already has nuclear weapons. But of course, I think China is much more concerned, and it would like a gradual transition. It's tried for years to get the North Korean leadership to look at the Chinese model of development to try and move the economy forward, and they haven't really listened. And I think, of course, China's concern is collapse would bring ultimately, the U.S. and U.S. troops potentially up to the border. But of course, the danger, including for China, is, as Ira said, the incentives for Japan, for South Korea, and a whole range of other countries to then develop their nuclear options, which seems to be quite capable for all those systems, makes it an incredibly dangerous place. So it does seem that now we seem to have shifted away from the earlier six-party talks to a much more reduced group to try and resolve this, with North Korea, South Korea, China, and America taking the key role. But I do agree that I'm sure they must have talked to Moscow about this during those visits, and I'm sure they will keep Japan informed. But one of the questions is, you know, would the North be willing to give up its nuclear development program in return for some kind of peace and security treaty and promises by the U.S. to stay to the south and maybe even reduce the troop numbers? It's a gamble, and I think impossible to say.
And just one last point on that last point. If you look at what President Trump is saying about Iran, that can have an impact on whether North Korea might be willing to.
Right. It doesn't help North Korean confidence in anything exactly. The United States says, if it can simply renege on a very important agreement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very good. I want to thank all of you, Zhang Tangjian and Ira Kasoff and Tony Sage for joining us on this grand tour of Chinese foreign policy around the world. And I want to thank all of you for joining us here today, too. So let's hear it for our terrific panel, even though it was all male.